Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center, conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
In thinking about my work on American economics, I'm always reminded of a special statement once made by Joan Robinson, a very famous economist of this century who was a very distinguished student of John Maynard Keynes in Cambridge, England. She once said that the purpose of studying economics is not to determine specific solutions to specific public problems, but to avoid being fooled by economists.
I don't mean to say that the artificial intelligence people are trying to put one over on people. I'm sure they're not.
Fair
they're doing
enough.
Something quite genuine and so on.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think there is this element. I think there is a danger there. And I think what perhaps one of the things I'm trying to emphasize here is not to, I mean, to, for human beings to keep their self-respect.
Welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Artificial Intelligence and Economic Policy. Two conversations this week on Soundings. My guests are Roger Penrose of the University of Oxford and Michael Bernstein of the University of California at San Diego. Soundings begins this week with a conversation featuring Roger Penrose of the University of Oxford. Roger Penrose is the author of The Emperor's New Mind, Concerning Computers, Minds, and the Laws of Physics, published by Oxford University Press. Following that portion of the program, I'll talk with Michael Bernstein of the University of California at San Diego. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Michael Bernstein worked on a study about the government, public policy, and the profession of economics. Roger Penrose, welcome to the National Humanities Center. Let's begin with a couple of generalities. What is strong AI, and why don't you like it?
Well, that was the term given by John Searle. I think it represents the point of view that all we do when we think is essentially compute in some way. I mean, I think there's the point of view that whatever's going on in the brain, it must be some kind of calculation.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we know that modern computers can calculate much faster than we can, much more accurately. And so the view is that as long as they know what it is we're actually doing, I mean, the point of view is that what we're doing when we think is simply calculating. And that if you have a machine which does the same sorts of calculations mm-hmm. that we do, it would be able to do it more effectively than we can. Now, it may well be that a lot of the things that go on in a brain are of a calculational kind,
mm-hmm.
but I'm trying to argue that mental phenomena like consciousness, things which are essential features of our thinking, but not unconscious thinking, which could be automatic, these things are not of a computational character.
Well, what's the difference between sophisticated computation and consciousness? Again, a very large question. How would you answer that relatively simply?
Well, there certainly are things which are known from mathematics which are not of a computational character. So although I think people think that anything you could describe in scientific terms you could, in principle, put on a computer. That's not mm-hmm. necessarily the case. There are things which are known not to be calculational in character. Now, it's not obvious that we're doing that kind of thing when we think consciously.
Mm-hmm.
But there are arguments which come again from mathematics, and I'm sorry one has to appeal to mathematics, but after all, the whole question of computational nature of things is a mathematical question. So one really has to address it, at least to some extent, in mathematical terms.
Well, now, as I understand it, computers work on a sort of on-off, one-two system, regardless of how sophisticated they may be in terms of what we ask them to do. They're working through a logical chain that has to one step follow from another. Consciousness doesn't work that way. I mean, it can work backwards and forwards and sideways. Are we on the mm-hmm. on the right track?
Well, we don't quite know what it does, but we do know some features of it. And
uh-huh.
and I think one of the critical issues is understanding. I mean, a computer does calculations, but without any understanding. And understanding is one of these things that is demonstrably of a non-computational character.
Mm-hmm.
And just when I say demonstrably, it does mean going through some of the mathematical arguments to realize that the whole very concept of understanding is something which you cannot reduce simply to computation.
Well, let me ask you this, Roger Penrose. How would you redefine the notion of intelligence or consciousness to accommodate the proposition that computers could think? I mean, if we don't come at it from one side, let's come at it from the other.
Well, I think a lot of people try and do that. If you're going to... I'm just saying that isn't possible, that what computers do is compute. They enact algorithms,
mm-hmm.
which is a sort of elaborate form of computation. But that what we do, what consciousness is something not of that character. I wouldn't want to redefine consciousness or something. I think you'd simply lose the concept if you did that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't think it's wise really to define it at this stage because we don't know enough about what it is.
Well, this calls to mind a piece I saw on the television news over the weekend about a professor at Stanford whose name is John Koza. He's proposing what he calls genetic logarithms. He's trying to figure out the relationship between computers and genetics. And as I understand it, his argument is that if you create a sufficient number of fields for which or in which a computer can search for answers, you can teach it to teach itself. Now, is that hopelessly optimistic in your view? How would you think about that?
Well, I'm not aware of the particular things here, but I would say that, you see, that isn't really any different from computation, because the ideas that people have of learning programs and so on, and I mean, it may be a good deal more sophisticated than other ideas that have come up. I can believe that.
Uh-huh.
But there are a lot of ideas running around now, for example, things called neural networks and so on, which do involve learning systems. And at first sight, it looks as though it's not a fixed algorithm. But in fact, it is, because the way in which these things learn is already pre-programmed right at the beginning. And so the whole system according to which it behaves is, in fact, set in. It's programmed right in at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not what I mean by something non-algorithmic.
We're talking apples and oranges then.
Well, yes. I think we need something quite new, which would change the actual physical principles that one's depending on.
Now, wait. Let me stop you, Roger Penrose. You say something new. Are you talking about the hardware? In other words,
yes.
Something into which we run these sophisticated computer programs.
Well, no, you see, because it's never... I'm saying it's not even a computer program.
Uh-huh.
The hardware would have to change... But it's something which you couldn't... It's not a computation. You see, I'm claiming what we're doing when we think consciously is not even a computation, not even something you could simulate. So that's where I differ from Searle, if you like, that I believe that you couldn't even simulate what we do.
In other words, you're talking about taking this whole proposition beyond the mathematical, beyond the computational.
Well, no, that... You see, let me make a clear point here. You use two words here, mathematical and computational.
And there's a distinction.
And they're quite different.
I see.
Yeah. I think one of the points I'm trying to emphasize is that computational mathematics is a very tiny part of mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very tiny part... It could be a very tiny part of what's actually going on in the physical world. I mean, the point of whether science can answer all these questions is a slightly different one. I don't know what I'd like to say there. I think science as it stands is too narrow.
Hmm.
But maybe the idea of science can be broadened and become more humanistic in its nature. But the other issue is, I keep wanting to emphasize, that artificial intelligence is very narrow from the point of view of science. Artificial intelligence, as we understand that subject now, which means computers,
mm-hmm.
There may be such a thing as genuine artificial intelligence. I don't believe that computers, as we understand the term computers now, will be able to achieve genuine intelligence.
Roger Penrose, tell me about artificial intelligence as this issue connects with education in the UK and in the United States. Do you think that there's a relationship between the two? Is it, you know, we've got the scientists working off in their ivory towers, and then we have all these awful stories about literacy and the failure, the breakdown of the educational system.
I agree that, well, let me just make one point, which is sort of relevant to the computers and AI and so on. I think there is this feeling somehow that, you know, that maybe you have systems which are supposed to teach people, and the human element is reduced and so on. In some ways it's efficient because each person can go at their own rate and have, you know, follow a certain set of rules which are all pre-programmed like that. Mm-hmm. But I think that's very bad generally for teachers. I mean, maybe it's nice to do that occasionally.
That would be the interactive educational system, the computers, yes, and the students.
Yes, I must say I'm very unhappy with that. I think the personal element is vitally important in education.
Are we taking something away from the education of our students or adding something to it?
Well, I must say I don't like the idea at all of doing it all by pressing buttons. I think that's going to be a terrible way of teaching generally. I think it's important in some, and I think I wouldn't say don't do it. And I think in a sense it adds something because there are aspects of teaching and also the game aspect of it that may be valuable to a child to to play around in an impersonal way with an impersonal object and develop certain skills in that way. But it's absolutely no substitute for the personal element. Mm-hmm. And so I think it does add something, but I think one should be careful and limit this thing to be only a comparatively small element in education. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, I think the personal element is vital, and without that, one wouldn't be able to teach effectively.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Roger Penrose. Do words like God, spirit, the supernatural, regardless of particular sectarian interests, do they play around in your mind when you think about computers and culture and the emperor's new mind?
Well, that's a difficult question. I certainly don't myself follow any established religion. I don't believe, in a sense, it's the same sort of humility. I think that people haven't appreciated what it really is. I think the way the world is and a word like God, the way that people use such a word, I think it doesn't conjure up the tremendous nature of this universe in which we find ourselves. So I suppose it's a little difficult to answer your question because I certainly don't believe that any of the established religions even really begin to come to terms with the enormity of what we see in the universe. So I wouldn't use the words perhaps in the same way that other people might use them. But I certainly believe that there is something tremendous and something wonderful that we don't appreciate. And it's not simply some mechanistic device in the sense that I think people understand that now, which is just sort of chugging away and we sort of somehow by chance find ourselves to be in. It's not like that, I'm sure.
You've said goodbye to Newton and his grand watch or clock.
Well, you see, that wasn't Newton himself. It's the way people look at Newton's universe.
Uh-huh.
And the term Newtonian world, in a sense, describes a kind of world, a sort of clockwork world, which was by no means Newton's own view.
Hmm.
His only own view he had much more humility towards the world and this particular picture that people attribute to him, I'm sure was not his view of the world.
Roger Penrose, thank you for stopping by the National Humanities Center. It's a pleasure to have you here.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Roger Penrose is a professor of mathematics at the University of Oxford. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Roger Penrose is the author of The Emperor's New Mind, Concerning Computers, Minds, and the Laws of Physics, published by Oxford University Press. Roger Penrose visited the National Humanities Center in connection with the opening by Oxford University Press of its new facility near Raleigh, North Carolina. Soundings on Numbers, Minds, and Public Policy continues now. My guest on the following portion of the program is Michael Bernstein of the University of California at San Diego. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Michael Bernstein worked on a study about the government, public policy, and the profession of economics. Here is Michael Bernstein.
Well, I'm interested primarily in revealing how the profession of economics has influenced the actions of the government with respect to economic life, and also how that involvement with the government has actually affected economists, the way they think, what they do, what they think constitutes appropriate economic reasoning and research.
All right, now how far back do you go when you speak of the profession of being an economist? Are we talking about what, the early part of this century? Are we talking about the rise of graduate education at the end of the 19th century?
Well, my research basically begins with World War I. Technically speaking, the economics profession, if we would like to date it from the founding of a professional association, dates back to 1885.
Okay.
I start with World War I for two reasons. One, it is a period when American economists first became involved with the federal government in a very profound way. And two, it's also a period of great social and political transformation in the United States. It's quite striking that in the World War I era, economists as a group, as a profession, were regarded as quite left-wing, actually. Mm-hmm. The formation, in fact, of the American Economic Association was undertaken by a group of reformers, people like Richard Ely of Wisconsin, who were very critical of the capitalist system and of laissez-faire enterprise. So that the appearance of the profession was of a group of iconoclasts to some extent in the earliest days of the association. And then over time, as I've begun to find in my research, the profession and its association and its representation in graduate training and so on became increasingly more mainstream, if you will, conservative. But to economists, they felt they were becoming more scientific, objective, rational.
All right. Now, the people who have exerted in some measurable, if not obvious fashion, an influence upon American culture, which is to say this group of economists, these would not be household names. And yet the results that we all live with, somehow or other, we want to attach them to individual names. I'm thinking, for instance, of a man named John Maynard Keynes. Tell me about what he, quote, stands for, as it were, as an economist. Where have we moved since Keynesian economics? What kind of an economic mindset are we living with here in the 1990s? That's a tall order for you.
Well, I think Keynes is a very good example. What he represents to all of us in the main is perhaps different from what he represents to economists as a profession. He represents to the reading public and to all of us who think about American life and affairs, a very powerful thinker who argued for greater involvement on the part of government in the workings of the economy. His most radical claim, in fact, was that the capitalist economy left to its own devices cannot generate full employment and prosperity. The government will have to intervene to do that.
And that would be a goal that all the economists and the government bureaucrats, apparently agree on? We want full employment?
Oh, yes. I mean,
That is an ideal, in other words.
Oh, absolutely. Even the most conservative economist who might disagree with Keynes's means, mm-hmm. namely government involvement, would agree with the end that we want an economy that allows all who are able and willing to work to find appropriate work mm-hmm. and achieve an appropriate standard of living as well. To economists today, Keynes, of course, is a great giant of the profession. There's less willingness today, I think, to agree among economists that he was right in all the particulars. And there's an increasing group of very powerful thinkers, some of whom are in Washington today, who argue that Keynes theoretically was wrong.
So we would associate not necessarily anti-Keynesianism, but a major qualification of what Keynes stood for as an economist with President Reagan, with President Bush, that sort of thing.
Yes, I think that's accurate. And in fact, I would go further in some cases with some of the economists who do work in government today in influential policymaking positions. They would argue that Keynes was wrong, and that uh-huh. what he spoke about in his very influential work, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, was about a particular period of time, namely the 1930s, when there was a worldwide crisis in uh-huh. capitalist economies. They do not feel that that argument is applicable today.
Michael Bernstein, we're talking about your overview of 20th century American economic thought, its relationship to the government. Let's put a wonderful word on the table that we all have trouble with. The deficit. Untangle this for
me. Well, the deficit didn't emerge overnight, and this is certainly not the first time in history that the United States government has spent more than it's taken in revenue. Obvious examples would be wartime emergencies. During World War II, we certainly ran a federal deficit. Of course, at that time, I don't think there was one member of the Senate or the House of Representatives who stood on the floor and argued that the deficit was destroying the body politic and should be eliminated. There was an agreement that an extraordinary emergency necessitated overspending in a time of crisis. Since World War II, of course, things have started to get out of hand, and we are confronted today with an enormous deficit each year and an ever-escalating mountain of debt.
All right, now who's listening to whom with what degree of accuracy here? The politicians or the economists? How do you? We're back really to our starting point here. How do we figure out what drives what?
Well, it's a two-way street, and again, as I say, it's quite complicated. I think economists throughout this century, not only in the United States but elsewhere, are very concerned, have been very concerned, with making their work useful for public policy purposes. They've listened, therefore, to politicians and to government bureaucrats when they face particular economic problems, and indeed, governments face the same problems as individual households. They have to make decisions about mobilizing resources for particular objectives. On the other hand, I think politicians, especially since 1945, have been quite impressed by the growing stature and authority with which economists deploy their arguments. And so, for example, many authoritative witnesses will appear before congressional committees, and I think politicians are less and less able and less willing to confront this expertise. They more or less listen. Keynes himself once said that madmen in authority, and he was referring in that case to Adolf Hitler, are usually the slaves of some defunct economist.
Yeah, well, this is like the atomic scientists turning up on Capitol Hill. We all sit and we say, they're the experts. We need to do what they're telling us. And yet somehow or other there is, if not a distrust, there's a suspicion when the economists turn up. Am I reversing the problem here? Is it our fault or is it their fault? I mean, the citizenry, is that where the buck stops finally?
I don't think it's the citizenry's fault. Of course, there is the famous expression that no one ever went bankrupt underestimating the intelligence of the American people. But I think economists have been guilty, to some extent, of overselling their product when they've appeared before Congress and presented arguments in a scientific way, as they would suggest. In fact, they are often making political arguments.
And the product you're referring to there, Michael Bernstein, would be what? The predictive element.
Prediction, suggestions about how to allocate government resources, suggestions about how various fiscal and monetary policies should be implemented. I do think your use of the word suspicion is an appropriate one. I think in general, the American public today has become increasingly suspicious of experts, not just of economists. The atomic scientists you mentioned are a good example. Nowadays, great concerns over nuclear power have led many people and whole communities to challenge the expertise of government witnesses when they come in and say, well, we can build a radioactive waste disposal site in your community. It will be safe. More and more people today are saying, I don't believe you.
Yeah, right.
And they don't say that because they just fall out of bed and think that. They look at a past record where mistakes and, in some cases, unfortunately, malfeasance and fraud have taken place, and they feel endangered.
Well, let me put this to you as a question. How should the American public listen to the economists? Do we all have to go out and, like you, get PhDs in economics to figure this thing out? Is it analogous to what we do at home once a month with the family checkbook? Where do we look for answers that we can have some sense of security
about? Well, I think this is a very difficult question because we live in a society where expertise recognized by professional associations, university degrees, and various positions of status, whether it be university professors or bureaucrats in government, this expertise is gaining increasing influence over our lives. People do not have the time or necessarily the wherewithal to study economics or sociology or medicine to be able to challenge the obiter dicta of experts on various issues. And therefore, we have to rely on what experts tell us.
Let me stop you. Do you, Michael Bernstein, when you read the newspapers, I mean, is it a matter of putting your faith in a particular ideological camp? Is this really an exercise in theology, after all? I'm going to make this leap of faith, and I like this group over here, so I'll believe what they're telling me.
Well, I think we all like to believe that our particular political convictions or policy ideas are grounded in some facts and theories that hold weight. In fact, when we talk about ends, when we talk about goals for public policy or the conduct of public affairs, on some levels, that is an ideological statement. It is a statement of faith, of belief, of worldview. Mm-hmm. And I get very suspicious personally when I read in the newspaper or listen on television to the testimony of experts who never admit or allow that some of the things they're saying are ideological. There's nothing wrong with that, in my opinion, but to suggest that one's positions or beliefs are simply scientific, quote unquote,
right,
I think is overstating the case.
Here's a footnote question, Michael Bernstein. What do you foresee over maybe the next 25 years or so in the relationship that exists between the incredible burgeoning of the political expression of democracy in Eastern Europe, for example, even possibly in China? We have yet to see how that threat will play itself out. And the American economy, the American political economy, as a model for these emerging democracies. Are you optimistic about that relationship?
Well, I'm quite struck by the developments in Eastern Europe and elsewhere in the world. It's quite exciting to watch. I am reluctant to draw straightforward analogies between what's happening there and what has happened in the United States in the past. I think, in fact, a more democratized Eastern Europe and Soviet Union, for example, will present ever greater challenges to the United States, not only in economic terms, because these economies will pick up and produce more and trade more, but also in terms of their commitment to a social framework of health, legal, and educational services. It's important to remember that these movements for democracy are not movements for a democracy in which there are no public provisioning of these services. This is not Reaganism in Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. This is FDR. Yes, FDR might be a more appropriate example. And so as these economies become more productive and more dynamic, whilst at the same time providing their citizenry greater health, legal, and educational services, I think that will begin to raise powerful questions in the American public mm-hmm. about the lack of such services here.
All right, and a final question here in our discussion about the American economy and the American government. I'm going to reduce it to a very personal level. Do you balance the checkbook at home?
Yes, I guess I do. We try to do it together, but I usually end up with that task.
Michael Bernstein teaches at the University of California at San Diego. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During a recent fellowship at the center, Michael Bernstein worked on a study about the government, public policy, and the profession of economics. Soundings on Numbers, Minds, and Public Policy is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 537. That's program number 537. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about the American short story and about contemporary literary theory. My guests will be Myra Jalen of the University of Pennsylvania, Paul Hunter of the University of Chicago, and Shannon Ravenel of Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.